Hello, everyone, and happy holidays from Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie podcast in ours, too. I'm your co-host, the very festive and overjoyed and exuberant Pisces, and this is my co-host.
I'm Aaron.
The rather dour and not particularly Christmassy Aries.
Dour?
Yes, dour. Would you rather me have said dowager? Because that's also
No, I would say more serious.
Cynical, perhaps. He's not quite a Grinch. I want to give him a fair amount of credit. He did help me put up the Christmas tree just now.
Of course, I always do.
Unfortunately, in the process, I broke my Little Mermaid Christmas ornament, so Christmas is officially ruined and canceled. Mm-hmm. So thank you all for joining us. I'm just kidding. I mean, I did break the ornament, but it's not ruined. Anyway, it is our last episode of 2022. As we announced last week, we're going on a bit of a hiatus after this episode, but we'll be right back with you in January. But anyway, for today, what are we talking about today, Aaron?
We are talking about the wonderful Bee movie, A Christmas to Treasure. It's a TV movie. Lifetime made this one, correct?
That is correct.
That's been made recently released for this year.
So it is true. Brand new. So we're leaning into our original brand here at Queens of the Bees, you know, celebrating the less illustrious elements of queer cinema. Not to say that this movie is bad, necessarily, but it is not quite... You know, it's not A-listers, let's put
it's
it that
pretty
way.
Bad.
Oh, shut up. So, it is not quite as good as, say, Single All the Way, which we did at this time last year, but I'll get into that a little bit later. So, I will give a brief summary, and then we can use that as sort of our jumping-off point. I want to just sort of preface our conversation by saying that this will be kind of a Siskel and Ebert kind of arrangement, where one of us is a bit more on this movie side, and one of us is not. I'll leave it to you to decide which is which. All right, so this, as Aaron said, this is called A Christmas to Treasure, which, in traditional holiday movie style, it has a really quite ridiculous plot, in which the character of Austin returns to his small town with his business partner, best friend, Tipper, where they are all gathering together to go on a basically treasure hunt, which has been put into motion by the death of Mrs. Marley.
Mm-hmm. So, if you're already a little bit confused, yes.
And so it's basically to find the treasure that she has left behind for this group of, you know, neighborhood children that she basically took under her wing, of which Austin and Tipper are joined by Everett, who is Austin's kind of love interest from high school, and then a sundry of other people who don't quite matter quite as much.
Wow. Way to completely dismiss all of the people of color in the movie.
I wish that the movie didn't dismiss them, but we also do have a couple of other characters that is worth mentioning. Clay, who is played by Norman Townsend, who's a basketball player, mm-hmm. and then his wife, Michelle, who is Asian American and is a publicist, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then there's Ricky. So there's this cadre of young people that have come back to town to reunite, to find this treasure. Everett, in particular, wants to use the money, if they find it, to save Mrs. Marley's house. So that's one plot point. Yes, I know it's ridiculous. It is quite, I think, self-consciously ridiculous in the mm-hmm. way that these movies tend to be, so that the stakes feel very low.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's part of the pleasure. Like, yes. I think that if you lean into the inanity of it all, that really helps you enjoy the plot more than if you were expecting sort of... this. It's a Wonderful Life, this is not.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's like I found some aspects of the movie enjoyable, but for the most part, I just felt like, I don't know, I felt like even for a cheap Lifetime type movie, this could have been better.
Okay, so what I liked about it, at least the plot-wise, I thought that the first half worked better than the second. Because mm-hmm. I felt like the zaniness of the treasure hunt, that's sort of almost arch comedy that we see, particularly like in the opening scene where Tipper and Austin are trying to do this pitch meeting. The quasi meet cute between Austin and Everett, I thought worked pretty well. And then the last half where it's getting into sort of the more emotionally quote unquote weighty stuff, I mm-hmm. felt did not quite land. But I think that's partially a function of the way these movies work, where everyone just sort of declaims their feelings about each other, mm-hmm. which is, you know, basically violating the show don't tell rule. Like, they just kind of beat you over the head with it.
Exactly.
And I think that's one of this movie's weaknesses, but I think that's partially just a function of the particular ecosystem in which it lives, and partially because people who are going to be watching this aren't going to be really paying attention, because they're going to be doing a lot of other things, like, while they're preparing for Christmas.
Yeah.
So I think that they have to sort of get away with that a little bit.
Exactly. And for me, that's the perfect reason why the movie fails, in my opinion, because I don't think that genre convention is a good excuse for crappy movie. Okay. And because the issue here wasn't really production oriented. It was really the script.
Yes.
And a better script would have cost no more extra money. I really think the script needed just a lot more workshopping to get past the everything is sort of at the level of dialogue.
Mm.
All of the meaning, all of this, whatever would have been subtext in a better written script was just sort of spoken by all the characters. And for me, because I've written a few scripts, for me, that's a draft one problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's, when I write a script, it's always just everything's in the dialogue.
Right.
Because I just want to get the idea on the page
mm-hmm.
first. And I feel like they didn't go back and revise this one. It just sort of stayed in that sort of first draft mode.
Right. So let's drill down a little bit on that. Because I think that that's particularly true. I think this is most evident with the Austin Everett mm-hmm. romance, which is obviously the key part. There's also the Tipper and the other guy's name, who has a name I'm blanking on. The Tipper and Ricky courtship, which is the other sort of subplot. Because
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, the people of color are kind of afterthoughts. Like, mm-hmm. they don't even get their own subplot.
Yep.
They're just kind of invited to town and then sent off to do things. And
mm-hmm.
everything they do is related via dialogue, which exactly. is itself a problem.
And of course, they're immediately the ones that are like, you can even take our part of the trip so that we really don't matter in terms of the plot.
It strained my infinite reserves of patience
yeah.
when it comes to these. I'm like, if you're gonna just make the people of color window dressing, then why bother including them at
exactly.
all?
Exactly.
Like, they just sort of feel ancillary to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Although the people who play them are incredibly attractive, as everybody is in these kinds
mm-hmm.
of movies.
Yeah, you've got the, what's her name, the one that played Michelle, who's gorgeous. What's
yes, her name is Nikki McKenzie.
Yeah, gorgeous. I've seen her in other things like her. And of course, you've got the low budget
Michael B. Jordan, the
yes.
Norman Towns.
Okay, so they're great to look at. They really could have just kept a picture in picture of those two on screen the entire time.
I mean,
and the movie would have been better.
Because there's a really embarrassing scene where they're all sitting around a campfire and they literally just tell the rest of the gang what they've been up to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, this is excruciating.
Yeah.
Like, it's so transparent that they're an afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we could have just had the four people who have anything to do with the plot.
Exactly.
But anyway, like, I think that's a sort of glaring problem in the script that's very vexing, given that it's 2022 and one would expect a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, the issue of this kind of show or showing or telling rather than showing phenomenon is most evident in Austin and Everett, because
yes.
the backstory for them is that they apparently had a quasi relationship. They were best friends through high school. At some point they had a kind of romance, but then Everett freaked out
mm-hmm.
and left. Basically, in the meantime, Austin is clearly very much not over his relationship with him and brings it up repeatedly.
Yeah.
And in a very, like, emotionally immature way. The other sort of thing that's always lurking in the background that we can't not be aware of is that the people playing them are actually married in real life. So that would be
Kyle Dean Massey and Taylor Frey, is it?
Yes, yes. Are actually married in real life. So that does add a certain kind of chemistry, and I think that works.
And see, for me, I'm actually gonna come at it from the other side, because I feel like, if anything, the movie relied on the idea that they're married, because I didn't actually see the chemistry between them. I don't think it actually came out, mainly because they didn't have a lot of opportunities to show it off. I feel like, honestly, had you not told me that they were married in real life, I would not have brought that to my viewing. I wouldn't have seen anything resembling
right. I think that dynamic emerges clearly in two scenes. One where kind of Everett is apologizing to Austin and they're kind of making peace. Like, they're standing on the porch and there's
mm-hmm.
like that meaningful exchange. Like, I felt that moment worked reasonably well
mm-hmm.
as far as like the characters. And I think that we needed more, many more scenes like that.
Mm-hmm.
The other scene I thought worked well was when they're standing on the boardwalk after Everett has accompanied Austin to help his father give away coats. There's a lot of plot going on. There's a lot of plot in this movie. So they're standing on, like, I don't know, this boardwalk or looking out of the mountains, and they talk about their lives. Like, Austin talks about kind of like the shallow life he's lived in LA with Chad and Brad and all of his revolving door of boyfriends.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Everett's talking about how, you know, after his parents' death, he, you know, had devoted himself to his career, but wanted to travel. So, like, again, that's a moment that needs more elaboration, and we need more of them so we understand these characters and their lives and their emotional investments and what they've been doing and why they're interested in each other. We need more of those moments mm-hmm. for this to really land.
Yep.
And we don't get it. Yep. And I mean, and even as someone who liked this movie and am willing to defend it to a certain degree, I wanted more of those, and I was afraid going in that that's what was going to happen, that we were going to be distracted by lots of other goings on, and their moments together were going to feel rushed, which is exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that's a function of this genre. I think it's a function of a genre that's still trying to figure out how to tell gay stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that is still trying to figure out how to toe that line of not... I mean, I think that they're trying to toe the line of not offending their, you know, their traditional audience, mm-hmm. which leans conservative.
Yeah.
And so I think they're still... I think what we're seeing here is still some growing pains of the LGBT Christmas movie. I think that's honestly what we're seeing. I think that some networks, and I don't want to repeatedly compare this to Single All the Way, but I'm going to for the moment because I think it's an illustrative... contrast is that Netflix can get away with a bit more because there's a bit more wiggle room. I'm not sure that Lifetime or Hallmark has quite that much.
Yeah, I think Lifetime certainly can. I mean, you can look at stuff that they showed, you know, in the 90s that I thought was more, that pushed the boundaries a little bit more than what you saw here. For me, it's like, and I think you're being very kind to the movie and very generous in pointing out some of these problems are part of the growing pains of telling gay stories. I don't even know that we're... I think it's just poor plotting. I think that we're not even to the point where we can talk about sort of how this works as a work of representation for a marginalized group because the writing is just so bad.
Well, I mean, I will say that the moment when they finally kind of, like, reconcile is so understated that if I had blinked, I would have missed it.
Because,
I mean, I think that there are two kind of narrative threads that are working and pulling each other apart. Like, on the one hand, there's the treasure hunt, which is fun and, you know, zany. And I think the movie works best when it sort of leans into that.
Mm-hmm.
When we see Austin and Everett confronting the snarky realtor, or when we see Ricky and Tipper doing the same thing. Like, those are the moments when I think this works. And that seems to me the kind of movie this wants to be.
Yeah.
But because it can't quite let go of the sort of social conscience part of it, then we get all these side plots of Everett's troubled upbringing, the fact that his much older parents, you know, rejected him at first before they accepted him, but then died, and so Mrs. Marley was kind of like his surrogate mother. All of that would work if it was a different movie that was focused exclusively on that.
Exactly.
But it feels, because it's kind of like jammed into an already very crowded movie, that a lot of the beats don't work just because there's just too much going on for an hour and a half movie on Lifetime to really accommodate.
Yep, like I say, the problem is script with this movie.
Right. Did you like anything about this movie?
I thought it was fun.
Right.
I thought, and again, I agree with your assessment of the first or the earlier parts of the movie where the treasure hunt sort of kicks off and is a more important part of the story before it's sort of very clear how it's going to be resolved. That's the other issue with this being one of these Lifetime movies is that the ending is telegraphed right from the beginning. We know how it's going to turn out because there are never surprises in these movies, which is fine. But it's why all the little details about how we get to the end of the plot matter so much. And it falls flat for me because I feel like the movie would have made more sense, for one, if it had stuck to being this sort of fun treasure hunt movie that just sort of had as its side point these possibilities of rekindling relationships from the past, if that had just been sort of a secondary thing thrown in on top of a plot about let's solve the mystery. I think that could have worked. I think a story that was more focused on relationships between, say, our two couples that get some screen time, forget the other couple because they don't get any screen time anyway. But if it was a sort of these two romantic couples sort of figuring out how they're going to, are they going to get together? Will they, won't they? With just sort of a smattering of a, and we also need to save this old lady's house. Okay, that could have worked, but it tried to do this equal balance between these two very different stories, and that I don't think worked. If it had gone for A story and B story, that I think could have been okay.
Yeah, and I mean, because I do think that, as I said, part of the problem is this, it's a very crowded movie. Like, I was reading Brett White's review for Decider, like, about whether to stream it or skip it, and before watching it. And he said that there's a lot of plot in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's true. And that kind of, like, I think robs it of some of the emotional impact that I would have expected, even in an admittedly rather, what do we want to call, less culturally prestigious genre, mm-hmm. as the, you know, the Lifetime Christmas right. movie. I mean, I was kind of struggling with it. Because, I mean, I felt moments of emotion welling up. And we all know that if you've listened to this podcast for any amount of time, you know that I'm an emotional mess during gay love stories, particularly gay love stories involving gay boys who missed their lover from high school that they mm-hmm. had a very big crush on.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that storyline, because that's the one that I felt could, like, I felt most echoing with me, but also kind of falling flat. So yeah. kind of, I had a split consciousness the whole time I was watching this movie, and I kind of was watching it through the lens of what I wanted it to be, at the same time as I was trying to, like, judge it on what it was, which is kind of a hard
mm-hmm.
kind of mental exercise, but I'm nothing if not game for that. So, you know, again, we get this repeated invocation of how much Austin was really in love with Everett. Like, mm-hmm. we hear that repeatedly. Like, and it's something that Austin has really held on to. Don't get me wrong, I can hold a grudge like no one's business. You can ask Aaron. Like, I will hold grudges for literally decades.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I will likewise hold on to loves for literally multiple decades. Like, I recognize that, and I think that that works in a plot. But I wonder if we can feel, if we can put our fingers on why that doesn't work, or how we can, maybe we can speculate on how it would have worked had it been done differently.
If it had a better script.
I know that, but I'm saying specifically, like, because I was trying to figure this out as I was watching it, why it wasn't quite landing for me. And I'm still trying to figure out if it's just the problem of this genre where everything is, like, declaimed, or whether, like, what we might have, how it might have been different if it had been a different kind of screenplay.
Well, for a couple of things, because I have some feelings on this. One, I don't think it's just a question of genre, because there are stories you can tell that are a lot to talk, mm-hmm. and it works. Like I said, other Lifetime movies I've enjoyed. So I don't think it's a genre problem.
Like the one Anita Broderick story? Arguably the most famous Lifetime movie?
Yes. Although I did love the Lifetime movie formulas when it was a woman struggle with fill in the blank. I thought those movies worked the best.
Or a woman scorned. Yes.
But so I don't think it's just that. I think you can do, let's just talk about shit and make it work.
Right.
When it's something that makes sense, that we're hearing folks talk about a lot of things, like the kinds of disputes where that would make sense. I mean, when you've got characters who, where their big thing is they just haven't interacted with one another in forever. The problem is that all they can really do is talk, because you can't really, you can show us them living separate lives.
Mm.
Or you can have that do what this movie tried to do, where they haven't talked in forever, and so they're trying to, like, okay, I guess you're here, we should speak. But there's not much to say.
Right.
Because they haven't spoken in so long. It's, you know, it's like, it was just a weird thing to make the central conceit of the movie.
Right, and I think part of it is because it's not really clear to me as a viewer what was this, like, first of all, how old they were when all this was
happening.
That's
the other point that I was going to make.
Secondly, like, how old they are now.
Exactly.
I'm still unclear.
So to help clear things up, the idea is that this whole supposed relationship thing happened, like, when they were, like, in high school, like 17, 18 or so. They're supposed to be about that age when that happened, right?
I think so.
Because it's supposed to have been in high school.
Right. I thought, but it was ambiguous. I thought I also got inklings of junior high, but I couldn't tell if that was my own biography.
I think that was, you know, it's like, I'm pretty sure this supposedly happened in high school. But the problem is, again, the question of how old are they supposed to be now? I mean, and this is the thing that makes the whole thing fall flat for me. It's like, these characters, their ages are not stated, but based on the appearance of the actors, they are too old for this story. The problem is like, this would have made sense if these characters were played by, like, 23-year-old actors who had maybe just finished college
mm-hmm.
and were rekindling after maybe 4 or 5 years. Maybe of not seeing one another, not like 15 years, which is more like what I think it's supposed to be. Because that's just too much time, and they should have grown up a little bit more in the amount of time that's there.
Well, first of all, I need to revise what I said earlier. It's not the Juanita Broderick story, it's the Betty Broderick story.
Yes, Betty Broderick.
That's what I meant to say. Juanita Broderick, of course, being the Clinton thing. So yes. I'm sorry for that mistake. So that's the first thing. But secondly, I'm going to push back a little bit. Only because, and again, this may be my own biography interfering with that particular line of argument that one should have grown up. Because just to say that Kyle Dean Massey, who plays Everett, is literally, like, older than me.
Yes.
He's born in 1981. To be fair, it doesn't look that old. Mm-hmm. But I have no idea how old what the other guy's name, or Taylor Frey.
Was,
I have no
idea. Born in 89.
Okay, so a little more feasible, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the movie's set now.
Right.
So, I mean, he's over 30.
Yes, I mean, the question is...
Not even just barely, he's in his 30s.
Well, sure, but I'm not clear that the characters are their actual ages. Really.
And that's why, so even if you shave off a couple of years, it's like, come on. And this is something that also that makes the weirdness around why Austin can't move on seem so strange to me, because this is something TJ and I talked about right after we watched, is that the movie makes clear with the other one,
Everett,
that part of his problem was that he couldn't accept his own identity. Mm-hmm. You know, as a teenage boy, his parents were not accepting, all of that kind of stuff. That's the kind of thing that I'm like, I don't understand why Austin didn't get that. Mm. Because even if he didn't know, even if it wasn't front of mind when he was a teenager himself, once it's been made clear to him as an adult that that's what was going on, that should have been, like, the most obvious thing in the world for him. Mm-hmm. But it's like he's still having this hard time just sort of letting go. And it didn't, for me, it didn't make it seem like this is someone who just sort of got this tortured memory of love. It just made him seem petty.
Mm. I mean, I will say that of the two performances, and I don't want to lambaste Frey too much. Like, I think that he's given not a whole lot to deal with.
Yeah, it's the script. It's not his fault.
But I will say that of the two characters, I actually found Everett to be a more compelling character. Yes. Like, and I'm kind of regretful that his was not the point of view that we got more of.
Yes.
Because, I mean, that's true that's just true of the kind of character that Austin is. Like, I mean, I know that the convention in these movies is for the big time, you know, gay who's making it big in the city comes back to small town. Like, that's just kind of the way this goes. But I don't find Austin that interesting as a character. There's just not a lot of depth there. Like, he's snarky and catty and bitchy, but, like, there's not, like, a lot of emotional depth. So I agree with you to the extent that I don't think that I was, like... I mean, I saw a lot of myself in him, but I think I have more depth.
Yes.
not very much, but a little bit more depth. And so, for that reason, it's kind of a struggle to be like, okay, yeah, I really want him to get with Everett. Like, I mean, I did want them to get together, but that's my own wish fulfillment. Like, that has little to do with what the movie is offering.
Right.
But we do get glimpses, like, of Everett's obvious, like, richness and depth as a character. Like, we see it from the very first moment that he's introduced, where, like, he's having this conversation with his friend Ricky that he wants to preserve Mrs. Marley's house, which, I mean, quite frankly, is not that nice of a house. I'm kind of confused, like, why it has... I mean, I understand the sentimental value, but I'm also just like, whatever. But
exactly. I mean, it's an interesting house, and I feel like they could have even explore the grounds and all this kind of stuff, but they kind of do it in these little vignettes. It needed a bit more complex cinematography to really show the layout of the place.
Yes.
Because, especially the way they resolve it, where they're like, we're going to save it as a park and make it available to the public. And I'm like, but you haven't shown enough of a reason why the city would agree to that. And I'm sure it's a lovely property. They could have just shown more of it to make that clear.
Right. So anyway, but be that as it may, like, I did find that, like, Everett's yearning for connection with Mrs. Marley and the obvious thing that they shared was convincing. Again, but it's still one of those things where I couldn't help but think, would a prologue have helped? Like, or some kind of flashbacks or something to give us the filmic material for this to actually land. Yeah. And I mean, I don't think that, you know, obviously flashbacks are a cheap device, but it's a cheap Lifetime movie, so I'm not sure, like, why they couldn't just have a flashback.
Because it's not cheap in the money sense.
Well, true, I guess.
Because you need to cast young versions of the actors.
Sure.
Maybe update the location so that they look older for the flashbacks and all. It's, production-wise, it's actually tricky. So that's why a Lifetime movie wouldn't do it.
I guess, yes. I just wanted something to give us the texture to anchor all of this dialogue to. Like, even within the constraints offered by a Lifetime movie.
Yep.
But speaking of Mrs. Marley, speaking of this property, I'm really kind of I'm perplexed by just how sprawling this particular, like, house is. Mm-hmm. Like, apparently there was a lemonade stand that, a full on lemonades, like an actual building that's used as a lemonade stand. Right. There's a clubhouse on this property.
Exactly, it's got all this stuff. And wasn't she a teacher?
She and her husband basically couldn't have children, so they adopted essentially these six kids, like neighborhood kids. Which there's something quaint about that.
Yeah.
Like I think that's a storyline that resonates with people of our generation. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that still happens. Or we could imagine it having now, but it makes sense that this would happen like in the 80s, like where, you know, there were always these, if you grew up in a small town like this, there were often older people who would kind of adopt neighborhood kids. I thought that was sweet. I thought that was a nice touch. And I do like the nice little flourishes that we get every now and again of this small town, which, do we ever get the idea of where it's located? Like, it seems like Colorado-ish,
somewhere,
I guess. Like, so, you know, I think that there are nice little, you know, grace notes of the small town, like, and, you know, the lives that the people here lead. Like, we, you know, Austin's parents seem like, upstanding parts of the community, for example.
Exactly. And even there, it's like, that was something where comparing the stories of the different characters and the ones who were sort of centered in the story versus the ones who were decentered, it's like, and this is just my own take on this, I wish someone had made a very strong suggestion to take Austin's family and to actually make them secondary and to actually center Everett as the primary character, because his background, I think, is just more interesting. This is not an attack on anything or anyone, but it just felt weird when, like, we decided to center the well-to-do, attractive white folks to tell this story. And it's like, not that there's anything wrong with being any of those things, but I just think it could have been a lot more interesting, because then we wouldn't have had to have Austin sort of somewhat vapid approach to things being the central focus.
Right.
That could have been maybe an opportunity for him to be a secondary character that sort of grows. Maybe that's his backstories. He was the one that was kind of vapid as a young person,
right.
but has since matured. Like, that, something like that would have been nice.
And again, I don't like to, as a general rule, as a critic, I don't generally like to hold films up to what I would have rather than be. I try to take them on their own terms. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to imagine, like, this might have worked better had we kind of really sublimated the straight people, like the straight couple, like the Ricky Tipper thing, which I really enjoy, by the way, which I want to get to in a moment. But if we had sublimated that and say, given us more scenes of Everett in his life in the town, like the fact that he's in good with Austin's parents, like that they kind of have adopted him as a second son, like elaborating that, like, so he gets as much, I think that would have made Everett more interesting and allowed that character time to grow and, like, really allowed us to appreciate that. At the same time as we would have been able to see, like, Austin, like, you know, like, there could have been a lot more, I think, done with them as opposed to what we got, which is, again, this very overcrowded screenplay with things that don't necessarily
exactly. And my suggestion would actually be a similar feeling, but I'd make a different suggestion, because I really also liked the straight couple in this, and kind of, I wouldn't want to take out any of their scenes, because actually, for me, their sort of will they, won't they is the most entertaining part of the movie for me.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the problem.
But I don't think that's a problem with that. That needs to remove that. I think the rest of the movie needs to be made as good as that.
Okay.
As opposed to reducing that to kind of match the rest of the movie.
Right. Because, as a sort of a throwback to way back at the very beginning of this entire podcast. So, and a little throwback, the woman who plays Tipper is Katie Walter, who plays the girlfriend in Shelter, which I thought that was lovely, first of all. Like, as a note, like, for us here at Queens, it was like, it was a sign from the heavens that I'd chosen the right movie. I was like, I could not have picked a right, and I didn't know she was in it until I started watching it. And I was like, oh my God, that's the girl from Shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So kudos to her for knowing her role in life is to play the gay guy's best friend.
And I'm like, she's done other things.
I know, but I'm just saying. But I appreciate that about her. And I did think that she probably had some of the I actually liked her as a character more than I liked Austin, which is a problem. Like, it's a problem that happens a lot in these kinds of movies, I find. Like, the secondary romance is actually more interesting than the primary one, which I get so frustrated, because it's like, that doesn't have to be that way. Like, you can have an actual compelling main couple.
Yeah, but I think it's because Austin is so plain. Like, he's just sort of like upper middle class white guy,
right?
Like, without a lot of substance to him,
right? And he's,
which for me makes it harder to care about you know, this torch that he's been carrying for so long, which, and I'm sorry to go back to this, even though we've belabored this already, but the other thing that makes this sort of hard for me to swallow, again, is the idea that I'm like, dude, you're like 32, 33 years old. And you've supposedly led this wonderful life, but you can't let go of this thing because you, like, kiss this guy a couple times. That was the other thing about their backstory about this relationship, is that it wasn't really even a relationship, is that it never turned into one. It was sort of like, obvious that they had feelings for one another, but they weren't, like, really a couple.
Mm. I mean, it doesn't help that, like, when they reconcile and have their kiss by the Christmas tree, as I alluded to this earlier, it just passes so swiftly that I'm just kind of like, this is the big romance. Like, why is this not... Like, where's the upswelling of music? Where's the melodrama? Right. Like, even in a genre like this, I would have expected something climactic.
Yeah, and that's where I thought the movie did something weird, because that choice, which I thought was weird, oddly fit with the very low stakes that I felt were associated with this relationship anyway. I was kind of glad they didn't make a big deal out of it, because for me, that would have just highlighted how empty it felt for me. It's like you have these guys who... 15 years prior kissed, and the one's just been sort of holding a torch ever since. And I'm like, and I understand it, like, if you're the one holding that torch, how powerful that might feel for you, but for everybody else on the outside, that's just kind of weird.
Right. I mean, the movie needs to do more to make that, to make us feel it. That's what I think. But yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that it can get there. And I even felt like, you know, the ending, which I'm a little frustrated by the ending, because what I expected to happen was that Everett would be like, would get the house, would turn it into bed and breakfast, which is what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
Austin would realize, hey, I can work remotely because it's the fucking 21st century in 2022, post-COVID. Mm-hmm. You can work as an influencer outside of LA.
Mm-hmm.
He would move back to be with his boyfriend. The end. Right. But instead, what happens... Austin's like, well, I'm going to give all this money, or Everett's like, I'm going to give this money to the town and they'll turn this house into a park and I'm going to move to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, why?
Which, honestly, for any outcome, since, of course, you know, it's this lifetime Christmassy type thing, it has to have this kind of happy ending, right?
Well, yeah.
But but for me, I'm actually glad they went in the direction that they did, because I would have been ready to throw stuff at the TV had it resulted the way that you hoped that it had, because you would have this already kind of ridiculous movie having the most ridiculous ending where you have this guy just, again, give up his whole life that he supposedly is happy in, his career that he's supposedly successful at, because now this guy that he kissed once in high school says, okay, let's date. Like, to give up everything for that would be absolutely insane.
Clearly you might, this is where our Pisces and Aries natures become very obvious.
Right.
And I was trying to explain this to my friend who's a Leo on an earlier podcast that we were doing about like the power of emotion and how you don't act rationally when you're, listeners, I don't know what to do with these fire signs. Like, I don't know how to explain to them the wish fulfillment element of romance. Like, it doesn't have to be realistic. That's, or even, like, responsible.
But what I love is that the ending that they chose, I think, works well. Because it makes far more sense, for one, for Everett to not actually keep the house. Because for him to actually put together the at least $250,000 that it would take just to keep the house. Not only to maintain it and keep it in perpetuity, but just to keep the city from taking it right now. He doesn't have that much money. And he doesn't have the prospects for getting it either. Him moving to LA makes sense because it's more like a chance for him to finally kickstart his life. Mm. It's like he's been kind of held back by all of the things that have been weighing him down throughout his life. But it's like now he's finally ready to move on. So him moving to L.A. actually makes a lot of sense.
Ugh, fine, I guess.
And it also is something that's a choice that he needs to make for himself, regardless of what happens with Austin.
Mm.
Austin coming home is just for Everett.
Right.
There's no other reason for him to come back.
Right.
So if they don't work, then it was all silly. But Everett needs a change anyway. Like, his life needs to change. Because that's the story that they set up. They didn't set up a Austin's life needs to change kind of premise. They set it up for Everett, though.
Yes, fine. Maybe, again, it's wish fulfillment. My own personal biography is very much interfering with my ability to judge this movie in any way, unbiased fashion.
Right.
But I just, you know, I agree with you, I suppose, cerebrally, but my Pisces heart suggests otherwise. But one last thing I wanted to talk about, like, you know, like I said, I think that Tipper is one of the best characters in this movie, and I think that her relationship with Ricky is nice and fun, mm-hmm. and the way that it ends where she's like, you want to, or he's like, she's like, do you want to be my date for the influencer ball that we're having? And he's like, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And like, that's nice. And I think it worked really well.
Like I said, they made sense to me.
And I mean, also, kudos though to the woman who played the realtor. Like, that's a very minor subplot. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wish it had been more present. Because the premise is that she's one of the avaricious realtor. You know, this very Karen-esque figure mm-hmm. who wants to sell the property for a huge amount of money to developers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And there's this very funny scene where Tipper basically bullshits this guy who wants to buy the property and bulldoze it. She's like, oh no, it's on the water table and all mm-hmm. that stuff. I'm bullshitting and blah, blah, blah. And Brett White pointed this out in his review. It's like a brilliantly acted moment mm-hmm. where, like, you know, Tipper's really just kind of bullshitting from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. It's doing it so convincingly. Right? And those are the moments that I think where this movie really sings. Exactly. Like, it really is brilliant. There's also a moment where Austin and Everett are giving away jackets to young people, and the realtor comes up and wants one, which is weird. It's like she would think, living here, she knows it's jackets for juniors or some other title. And he's like, reads her the right act as to like why she's not going to get the property. Also a very fun moment. Mm-hmm. And I mean, those are the moments when I think these kinds of movies are genuinely pleasurable to watch, because, you know, the quasi arch dialogue that's, you know, clever and quippy, I'm putting all these in very heavy quote marks, are fun because they're so self-consciously silly that's where the real pleasure comes from.
Yes.
Less frequently do the emotional moments land. And I mean, if we're thinking about why these movies exist as, you know, forms of wish fulfillment, of cheap wish fulfillment, mm-hmm. I was wishing for just a little bit more so that the emotional pleasures of it would be a little more impactful, even within the sort of limited emotional range that we get from a Lifetime holiday.
Exactly. Had this just been sort of a quirky mystery comedy about the treasure hunt, I would have been fine with it.
Right, with that little romance thrown in at the end. I think that if they had just bracketed out the heavy, weighty romance part and just like had it be a funner romance, mm-hmm. I think it would have worked a lot more feasibly. And if it had just been like they flirted in high school but never really did anything mm-hmm. without all the other emotional baggage that comes along, like that would be fine too.
Yeah. Or, I mean, since we're rewriting the script, and like something that I think could have been really interesting would be to have Everett and Austin actually have dated in the past, so that instead of this being a story about Everett and his like lifelong battle against homophobia, we could just sort of make it not an issue and just actually have it be that their relationship ended badly. Right. And that way there's actually more personal stakes involved in this. Or that, you know, that they broke up and Austin never got a reason or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I think there's just not enough. I mean, for a movie that's so talky, it's not very it doesn't clarify very
because
much.
Those are the kinds of things where, again, like I said before, there are movies that are very talky and it works. Those kind of premises lend itself to that because there's actually stuff to explain between the characters.
Right. I mean, as we've said before, you know, earlier in the discussion, like, if there's a lot of talking but not a lot of substance said, it's because it's just the same refrain.
Exactly.
So it's not like elaboration. It's just like repeating. It's like, to use a writing metaphor, it's like a student paper where they just make the same claim repeatedly but don't actually like support it with anything.
Yep.
So I mean, dialogue heavy is fine. I mean, that's why plays work, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, but you need to have the dialogue say something and advance in some way.
Exactly. This could have been, especially with the treasure hunt and all this kind of stuff, and the characters actually revealing things, if they had made it more about the characters revealing things about themselves that the other characters didn't know, that would justify the talkiness, I think. But we didn't go with that premise nearly enough. It's like there should have been a lot more revelation between particularly Austin and Everett, but for all the other characters to explain why they're talking, because otherwise they're just sort of explaining things in that sort of like, as you know, I always did this thing when I was a kid. Well, I wouldn't say that to my best friend that I hung out with all the time because they already know. So I don't need to say, as you know, we did all these things together when we were a kid.
Right. But I mean, overall, I did think that it was a fun movie. I enjoyed the first half more than the second, I will be honest. Like, And I mean, the small town kid in me, I mean, admittedly, this is a much, much posher small town than the one I grew up in.
Slightly more.
I mean, Cameron, West Virginia does not have this, does not, I don't know that there's any house at Cameron that would be worth $250,000.
No, that was just in back taxes, what, that's not the value of the property.
I can't even imagine. Right? How much.
That's just what they owe the city.
And she also has these, what, South Sea Pearls or some shit? Like, like I said, there's a lot going on.
And,
like,
and she was a teacher, right?
Well, I guess you make a lot of money in whatever school system this right. is. But I just wanted to, you know, as we leave behind the plot discussion and, you know, that sort of thing, I do think it's somewhat useful also to sort of situate this movie in a broader cultural context that we're now living in. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, part of the reason I loved it, I guess, is because, as you may have guessed, I'm a Christmas gay. I love Christmas. I've always loved Christmas. I love all the things about Christmas. But I've always felt shut out of, not shut out, I guess. I've had a complicated relationship with Christmas movies. Like, as queer people, we're always in a kind of vexed relationship with pop culture, as we know. So, you know, I would look at something, you know, the Lifetime Christmas movies of yore and the Hallmark Christmas movies of yore, and I would lust after the boys, obviously. So it is kind of nice to see this introduction of queer storylines, no matter how imperfectly rendered they might be. And I think that it's also important to situate this, like, and it's impossible not to view this in comparison to, say, Hallmark, which is making a similarly much belated, you know, venture into LGBTQ holiday storytelling, which has led to a very public rift with Candace Cameron Bure, who, as we all know, is sort of like, was firmly associated with the Hallmark brand, mm-hmm. but has now departed because she does, basically, she didn't like seeing gay people get their own Christmas movies. Mm-hmm. And so now she's like Great American Country or whatever. And so I think that it's important to sort of recognize why this representation matters, even if it isn't perfect. Like, as you have said on this pod before, mm-hmm. the straights get shitty gay movies, shitty straight, you know, romance movies all the time. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's okay that we also get them.
Yeah.
As frustrating as it may be as a viewer to watch them.
All right.
And I also think that, you know, hopefully this will be, and I know this is like, I think the third Lifetime gay, or sorry, yeah, Lifetime movie. And I think it's, you know, I don't know yet enough about the distinction between Lifetime and Hallmark as their own ecosystems, as far as, you know, they're basically studios mm-hmm. of the old kind of Hollywood, because they have their own stable of stars, their own stable of, like, their own style. Mm-hmm. I think it would be fascinating to see, as the number of queer stories from these two kind of big heavy hitters when it comes to holiday movie programming, as they become more diverse, if there's a sort of distinction between their styles. I don't know yet, but I would be interested to see if there's a difference between, say, Hallmark Christmas movies and Lifetime Christmas movies.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, their other stuff's already so similar. I just
some people. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I also, mm-hmm. you know, I was thinking back also to the how kind of low profile this movie is, to say something like Single All the Way, which came out from Netflix last year and was much ballyhooed because of, you know, Netflix getting into the Christmas movie game. It also had Jennifer Coolidge, and as anybody who's listened to this knows, mm-hmm. I will literally worship at the altar of Jennifer Coolidge till the day I die. But I, you know, I really appreciate that, you know, we're seeing this movement in these big purveyors of holiday entertainment. Mm-hmm. So regardless of how good or not they may be, I think that it's in the broader scheme of things a good thing, particularly as, you know, the culture war battle over queer representation continues to be a hot war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, I agree with everything you've said. The one thing that I will sort of say, just from my own little counterpoint, is that I wish this movie had something to say. Like, and I am perfectly fine with the idea of queer themed movies that are basically garbage, that don't say a lot. Mm. But I still kind of want them to say something, and I'm still trying to figure out what this movie was trying to say at all. Mm. Like, this felt very much like such a genre film that I'm having a hard time trying to figure out what its individual message would even be. Mm. Like, what's, like, why this as opposed to literally any other scenario that we could have come up with for a holiday movie. Like, I'm still trying to figure that out for this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I am too, quite frankly. And I think that, you know, I'm not sure that it's going to earn a place in the Christmas canon.
Yeah.
Unlike, say, Single All the Way, or even Happiest Season, which I also did not like particularly much. But I do think it was, I think we had a valuable conversation right now around this movie, mm-hmm. and not just because we had our returning character from, our cast, I mean, from Shelter, but also just think it's interesting as part of a phenomenon. Like, mm-hmm. It's an emblematic text in that sense of this shift that we're seeing and how the holidays are being understood to be queer inclusive in a way that has not always been the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is definitely nice. And it's actually one of the reasons why I like the fact that although the relationship between Everett and Austin was centered here, it wasn't sort of the exclusive focus, because I like, in order to fit that sort of queer representation into this larger framework of other stuff, I think it's important that it not just be like, this movie is just about these two gay men.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're trying to fit it into this larger paradigm, it can't just be that. It has to reach out and be about other things, too.
Right. Yeah. No, and I think that, you know, I do hope that as the years go by and we get a larger sort of developing canon of queer-centric stories, I hope that, you know, even if this is an ultimately expendable movie, mm-hmm. like a sugary confection, yeah. if you will, to strangle a metaphor to death, I hope that, you know, we get more like this and that it helps, that they hone their skills, and that if my theory proves to be correct, that they're sort of just figuring out how to write very good queer mm-hmm. romance holiday movies, that they get better as the years go by.
My fear is that it's more emblematic of a general problem with script writing for these kinds of like factory approaches to writing movies, because just from, and I'm not a huge aficionado of these kinds of movies, but I've seen a few, you know, sort of that are not queer themed that have the exact same scripting problems from Hallmark and Lifetime, and that I think it's a shortcoming of that approach to movie making. It's like, just get something done. It's like, we've got something that we can kind of call a story, go ahead, make it, and then move on.
Right, I mean, and so I guess, you know, the larger sort of social question is, I mean, clearly these movies are still doing bang-up business, in the sense that they're just expendable, so they can get them out and get them into the world, and people just put them on as background noise. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole, I mean, I don't have a lot to say about it at this exact moment, but it does strike me as being an interesting conversation to have about what's the kind of cultural work these movies are doing. What's the cultural work that expendability is doing?
Yeah, and I also think that there's another question that could potentially be even more valuable for this, and that is with this idea of trying to put queer stories into these contexts where we haven't had them in the past. And not just in terms of genres like Christmas movies, but in terms of institutions like Lifetime and Hallmark that haven't always centered queerness in these ways. By doing this and still trying to fit into the paradigm of basically being completely inoffensive, sort of broad appeal, simple enough to follow when you're not really paying much attention, because as you point out, these are the kinds of movies that are often watched while people are doing other things. When you're trying to tell those very simple, inoffensive stories, maybe there are just limited ways of getting that right. Maybe there's only so much you can do when you're working with that kind of constraint. And maybe movies like this will help us to figure out what those limits are.
Right. So what you're saying is that you and I should pen a script and try to have a gay holiday movie and send it to Lifetime.
Yes.
That's what we should do.
I say we should do a rewrite of this movie and say this is what you should have done.
Well, I mean, these movies are all the same plot anyway. So they're going to, I mean, almost certainly we're going to see a treasure movie like adventure.
We should literally track down a copy of their script and correct it.
I mean, like I said, that's the brilliance of formulaic plots, is that you just plug in you just shake it all up and get the new another result.
Yeah, you're true, and you end up with this movie when you do that.
Well, I mean, you have to,
so that's the downside.
Well, I mean, yes, but there are, I mean, as classic Hollywood showed us, like, you can make convincing storylines even in a factory system.
Mm-hmm, yeah, you can, but that doesn't mean that you aim for the worst.
Right.
It's like you have to approach all of those movies as if they're going to be your masterpiece.
Right.
You give it the care that it deserves as a movie. And then it ends up maybe just being sort of disposable or whatever. You don't aim for disposable.
Right. Yes. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, that, you know, A Christmas to Treasure is disposable. But I think it's, you know, I think it's, like I said, there's an interesting conversation to be had about the nature of disposable media.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when it comes to queerness. Like, I think that's a really fascinating discussion that's a bit beyond our scope today, but I do think that that's an area that is worth thinking about, particularly if it seems likely, you know, queerness is now being incorporated within the systems of Hallmark and lifetime, but not notably Great American Country, where Cameron's Cameron is now. But so it's a whole just, I think it's fascinating. I think this movie is fascinating both in itself, but also for the broader phenomenon of which it's a part.
I just think it's a very, very bold choice for any organization, person, or whatever to try to say, I want to make a bunch of these schlocky movies, especially those that have holiday themes, but do it without any queer people. I'm like, go right ahead and try. try making these movies without an art department, basically.
Exactly. Well, I think this has been a really fruitful discussion. So, Aaron's giving me a scathing look.
I am not at all. He just made that up.
I did just make that up. But anyway, we'll be right back with a brief little holiday message, and then we'll do our social media. Okay, so I'm not going to belabor this point too much, but it's a little PSK, which I like to have every now and again. So recently, we were watching Abbott Elementary, another great queer show, if you haven't watched it. And Jacob, who's the, you know, the resident queer character, speaks about, like, he's very grinchy and is, like, trying to rain on everyone's parade as far as Christmas goes. And I noticed this as a phenomenon I've been seeing a lot in social media with queer people kind of, like, being performatively negative about the holiday, which I understand. Like, you know, as we've talked about in our previous discussion, Christmas is often a very vexed time for queer people.
Yeah.
But I would like to just shift it to say that, you know, is there any gayer holiday than Christmas? Like, that's one thing I wanted to say. Like, I do think that... But also, as with so much of else that comes with queer life, we can also find reasons to celebrate at the holiday season. Like, I think that you can bring queer joy to the holiday. I don't think there's anything inherently queerphobic about Christmas.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that I just want to push back, and I don't want to, like, exaggerate the way, like, the dominance of this discourse, but I do think that the Jacob storyline in Abbott Elementary, the Christmas episode, is a useful learning experience because, you know, he doesn't say it explicitly, but it's clear that his family's homophobia has played a part in his antipathy toward the holiday, and I'm sure that's true of many other people, but I also think that offering grace is also a valuable thing for queer people, and accepting grace too, like, I think is really important. And, you know, my own family is not particularly, like, queer accepting, but they're not queerphobic either. But I think that now is the time of year, whether you are a person of faith or not, where I think a little bit of grace can really help make your life better and make the world a better place.
Yes. And I really want to focus on that last part about making the world a better place. There's something about that sort of, you know, critical mode of the folks who would do like Jacob was doing, where he's just kind of shitting all over the holidays and all the kind of stuff. I understand where it comes from. Fine. I'm not going to comment on that. But I guess I don't understand what it is you think you're... I don't understand what it is you think you're doing when you go around sort of shitting on other people's good times. Like, what actual effect do you think that has? I mean, because honestly, what it ends up being is it's sort of like, you feel bad, so other people should too.
Right.
Instead of going in a different direction and saying, I feel bad, why don't I do something to not feel so bad?
Right.
Why don't I try to spread some of the joy that I wish to have in the world? Why don't I try to do that instead? That kind of approach makes a lot more sense to me. That tends to be more my speed when it comes to these things.
And I mean, I agree with you 100%. And I mean, although I can be bitchy and complainy, I'm generally an optimist and I like making the world more joyful. And don't get me, and I find that social media makes this exponentially worse because people feel like they need to, like, externalize all of their negativity and how miserable they are during the holiday and how it's so difficult seeing people celebrate. And, you know, all the kind of, like, if you're happy, you should feel guilty. Like, and there's something really toxic about that. I'm just going to be honest. There's something really toxic about that. And I feel like it's getting validated far too much.
And I'm going to say, I'm going to use a stronger word than toxic. I think it's downright dysfunctional to behave that way, and a sign of not great mental health. Like, it's, and that's something that I think we really need to pay more attention to. Especially for us queer folks, because a lot of us have experienced things that can sometimes make it harder to get through life. But I think that sometimes we have a way of sort of normalizing our pain instead of seeing the pain itself as a sign of something that is aberrant. Right. It's like, no, we're supposed to be angry and vindictive and all the kind of stuff. That's how we're supposed to be. I'm like, no. If you're feeling that way, that's a sign that something's wrong.
Right.
And we should try to fix the thing that's wrong.
Right. And I think that, I mean, at the risk of overstating the case, I think that part of this is a function of the sort of wholesale acceptance of the queer negativity model that's come out of academia mm-hmm. and queer theory. And I think that's a mistake.
Yeah.
I do. I truly think that negativity is a force for corrosion and social mm-hmm. corrosion. So rather than embracing the negative side of life, I would propose as part of this PSG and as part of our farewell to 2022 here at Queens and our expression of joy and thankful and gratitude for all of our listeners who still tune in for mm-hmm. us every week, that we all do our part to extend grace.
Yeah.
We expect it other people to give us grace, so why don't we do our part by offering it?
Mm-hmm.
If it's rejected, then so be it. But yeah. as I said to a friend of mine a few weeks ago, the thing about grace is that you don't expect it in return. It's given without any expectation of return.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a very valuable thing to take forward into the holiday season.
Exactly. And it's not even just that you don't expect anything in return. You do it because it's what you think the right thing to do is.
Right.
It's not about whatever response you think you will get. It is about doing what you think is right.
Right. And I mean, I think that's what Abbott Elementary teaches us with mm-hmm. the Jacob storyline.
Exactly. Because one of the things with that storyline that I'm glad they didn't belabor it, because, you know, it's an ensemble show. It's not just about Jacob. But one of the ways they establish, you know, ultimately his change of heart is that he comes to realize how much he's being a downer toward his partner who loves the holidays. And that Jacob's insistence on being dour and angry and all this kind of stuff is causing a problem in his relationship. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that they went in that direction, rather than it just being the sort of general, don't be a Grinch.
Right.
Because one of the things that did was it reminded us that as queers, we have lots of different stories. We don't just have one story.
Right.
And the negativity folks sometimes forget that.
Yep.
They sometimes act as though, oh, my family rejected me, or they made the holidays a tough time, or whatever, and that is the only story. That is not the only story. That's never been the only story.
Right.
That we have lots of stories. They all matter.
Yep. That's really good. That's really profound. I like that.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you again, everyone, for joining us for another great episode of Queens of the Bees. I loved this discussion. I was looking forward to this discussion ever since we finished the movie last night.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you to Aaron for giving his usual robust conversational skills and, you know, ability to spar with me. I appreciate that.
And thank you, TJ, for bringing your exuberance to everything that you do, not just this podcast, but also for getting me to watch this movie. This is not at all the kind of movie that I would have chosen to watch.
That is correct. So I'm glad that we did this. And we are very glad for all of you. And we're going to continue to grow here at Queens. Like, we have lots of exciting things in store for 2023. Although we're still kind of a growing podcast, I genuinely do enjoy doing this. I enjoy sharing my thoughts with Aaron. And really, I do enjoy sharing it with all of you and knowing that people are listening to us. It's truly a blessing. And I really say that from the bottom of my heart, that I really appreciate all of you who have listened, who have stuck with us through host changes, through some, you know, through some scheduling stuff. We appreciate it, and we are really looking forward to a whole host of new things to talk about in the forthcoming new year.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the spirit of Christmas, I'm not even going to badger Aaron about not being on social media, because given the chaos at Twitter, I really can't blame you.
Right?
It is.
I've been right all along.
He has been right all along. But if you are still on Twitter, you can follow me out there at TJ West in the number 3. If you're on Instagram, which is mostly less chaotic than Twitter, then you can follow me at Thomas West in the number 3. But also you can follow our Queens of the Bees Instagram, which is at Queens of the Bees without the apostrophe. So Queens of the BS, basically. appropriate, as it were.
Right.
And then, of course, if you want to see my writing and what I've been yammering about over on Substack, you can follow my Substack newsletter, Omnivorous, where I do frequently write about gay stuff. So I really, really appreciate it if you check that out, too. Subscribe if you like. It's free. Or you can pay me. I do enjoy money as much as the next person. So please do that. And lastly, if you have an opportunity and you have a couple extra seconds, please do rate or review us wherever you get your podcast. I know that Apple is where a lot of people listen. So if you could rate us and review us there, that would be greatly helpful. In the spirit of the season, I would ask that you give us grace and that you give us only positive reviews. But if you feel the overwhelming urge to give us constructive criticism, I will accept it in the generous spirit with which it is offered. So please do that, because it does help build our visibility and it makes it easier for people to find us, which we definitely want. So thank you once again, everyone, for a wonderful year here at Queens. It's been a year of great change for us, and I predict great things coming up in 2023. So on behalf of both of us here at Queens of the Bees, we want to wish you all a very happy holiday season. We hope you have a wonderful time filled with love and celebration and joy with your family and loved ones, and we will see you all in 2023.